Welcome to The Archive Project.
I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for The Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. Find these and more at colehaan.com. In this episode, we feature writer Daniel Handler, otherwise known as Lemony Snicket, from an event recorded at Wordstock, Portland's book festival, in November 2017. 13 volumes compose a series of unfortunate events, the internationally acclaimed and best-selling children's book series. And for a long time, the author was only known as Lemony Snicket. These slim novels marked a departure from the way many kids' books were written. Gone from Snicket's series is moralizing and lesson teaching. His stories do not seek to make the world seem happier, safer, or more beautiful than it is. Instead, the series harkens back to our earliest fairy tales, depicting hardship and pain in a world that is confounding, where bad things can happen for reasons that are elusive. I think young readers responded with such enthusiasm to these books because they reflected the often confusing world they actually faced, and the stories did not condescend to them. This is what makes these novels matter and what makes them enduring. Lemony Snicket was later revealed to be the writer Daniel Handler. In addition to the series of unfortunate events, Handler is the author of many other children's books and young adult novels. He is also a poet and a writer for the screen. And what I love about this episode is that Handler really opens up about his life and his writing process and talks about the tradition of literature as a conversation that is both with history and with his contemporaries. He is joined on stage with the New York Times journalist Gilbert Cruz.
Thank you, everyone, for being with us so early on a Saturday morning. Thank you, Daniel, for being here.
Oh, certainly.
I had a first question queued up.
Okay, let's get right to
it. The first question was, because you always wear a suit, why are you wearing a suit this early on a Saturday morning? I thought that would be clever, but you're not wearing a suit. So why are you not wearing a suit this early on a Saturday morning?
I don't mean to insult the generosity of other people,
yeah,
because I have traveled this world and met many wonderful people, but I'm traveling extensively right now to speak about books, and someone left as a gift a small tube of lotion in my suit, which I learned only this morning appeared to be sensitive to airline travel. So I could either dress less formally or I could look as if I had narrowly escaped being murdered on the way. And both of those were very tempting, but I decided on less formal dress, so sorry.
I'm sure the audience will forgive you. A few weeks ago, I was sent a packet with a lot of your books, many of them children's books.
How did it arrive?
It arrived in the mail.
Okay.
Okay. a bizarre gentleman dropped them off at my place of employment. I don't know.
Well, you work for the Times, so I bet you have a large desk crowded with things that people have sent you.
Yes, we are told never to go in the mailroom because sometimes people send scary things to the mailroom.
I bet.
Some of those scary things are books, like your books. And
okay.
Three of those books were one of the books that you are going to be signing later today, The Bad Moon, The Stick, which is about a literal bad mood that jumps from person to person, sort of like a demon in a movie, in a horror movie. There's The Dark, which is a story about in which the dark of a big house at night sort of becomes personified. And then there's a book called Goldfish Ghost, which is about...
a dead goldfish.
A goldfish ghost.
Yeah.
I have a three-year-old son. He loves the books.
That's nice to hear.
He finds them delightful. My wife is more dubious. She thinks maybe we shouldn't be reading him books about ghosts and the dark at his age.
Well, I'm glad that after proposing on a nearby beach, you have married a sensible woman. I think there'll be much peace in your household as a result.
You wrote Goldfish Ghost with your wife?
Yes.
Lisa Brown.
My wife was, we were sitting out staring at the sea. We were at a conference. We were at a children's literature conference, and she was drawing a dead goldfish, as is her wont.
Mm-hmm.
And I began to think about a dead goldfish floating around, first on the surface of the water and then out in the world. And so I sat next to her and wrote a story, which is not usually how I have collaborated with an illustrator, including the illustrator Lisa Brown, but it was very nice to sit outside by the sea and think about death. I enjoy that.
What mindset do you have to put yourself in to write a kid's book? You've written a lot of books for different ages, and these are sort of very specific. Do you feel like you have to have a moral lesson in there? Do you think you need to write it in a way that a kid that you would have understood when you were 4 years old?
I just like to think about different types of books. Picture books are, I think, particularly difficult to categorize when you're talking about an age, because of course picture books are purchased or borrowed from a library and then read by adults, almost exclusively by adults. There might be a child sitting on the lap of the adult or next to the adult on the bed, but they're read by adults. And so it's difficult to say that you need to write a story that is like a young child would read, because the young child is not reading them. Maybe the young child may be in fact eating the book. But a picture book as just a kind of book to write is interesting to me. You have to think about making the text very short, and then the text needs to describe things, and then the illustrator draws them, and so then you remove the description from the text. And I like that a lot. I like making things shorter. So I couldn't picture a whole novel about Goldfish Ghost or a sequence of 13 novels about a goldfish ghost wandering endlessly. Now I can, actually, but at that time I couldn't picture it. So I guess my mind adjusts accordingly to what seems right for the story, rather than thinking about the age of the reader, particularly because I don't think the age of the reader is actually, I think that's in fact fictional. Children's literature is read by all sorts of people in all sorts of circumstances. Adult novels, for lack of a less smirky term, are read by an even wider age range of people. And so in the same way that nobody says, I'd like to write a book for someone who's 41. I don't think deciding to write for someone who's 3 makes any sense.
It's a very good point. That's a very good point.
No, thank you. Yes.
It's a point we should applaud, more specifically.
Yes, I'm sorry. We need a neon light for the applause lines or something.
So you've written kids' books, you've written YA books, you've written, to use the category terms of the book industry.
Yeah, no.
Picture books, YA books,
yes.
Adult books, poetry. You've written songs.
Kind of, yeah.
You've played accordion on those songs.
It's true.
You've worked in film and TV, and you have a play that is out in Berkeley Imaginary Comforts.
It's being performed a few more nights in Berkeley, California, if anyone would like to leave.
It's called Imaginary.
If anyone who right now, somebody who's so entranced in my work that they would like to leave the auditorium where I am sensibly and fly to the Bay Area to see a play, you would be most welcome.
What is the full title of the play? I'm sorry.
It is called Imaginary Comforts, or The Story of the Ghost of the Dead Rabbit. And there are many things that I thought I would never do and even said I would never do, and one of them is write a play, and one of them is write a book with, or a thing with a title with the or thing, which often I think, well, just make up your mind, author, what is it?
So you just got them both out of the way with the same project?
Apparently, yes. I didn't, unusual for me is when I was writing the play, I didn't know what I was writing. I was writing, as I like to call it in my house, a thing. I was writing a thing. And I wrote it shortly after the death of my father, and I was just kind of writing every day, not for any purpose, but just to do something every day besides be sad. It's good to have variety. And So I was writing something a little bit, and then I put it away for a long time when I was done writing it, and I hardly thought of it, actually. And then I took it out again, and I said, how terrible is this? And then I thought, oh, you could make it a little better. And then I thought, oh, it's a play. Oh, no. And it is only because I'm married to a woman. We got engaged in New York. She proposed to me in a tiny, crappy apartment crawling with bugs. And she hates the theater. She hates it. And so I had to sit her down and say, I've written a play the way I might have said, I'm having an affair. I had to say, I need to tell you something. I've made a horrible mistake. And you're going to be very angry, but we will get through it. And she took it pretty well.
Yeah, yeah. How many times has she seen it?
She's seen it once, really. She went to a little workshop thing where we were kind of doing it, but then she went to opening night with me, which was very generous of her. But she, it's mostly that she finds that bad theater is more embarrassing than bad anything else.
Mm. More than bad stand-up? That's the worst.
I think that I agree that would be worse. I think a bad meal is worse. Mm. Particularly a bad meal presented by people who believe it's a good meal. Mm. You know, if you have a sandwich on the airport, there's no one there who says, like, here is my magnificent sandwich. But sometimes you go some places and they say, the chef has prepared this for you. And you think, that's no chef. What's wrong with you? Do you find you is bad television? How mortified are you by television?
The wonderful thing about bad TV is you could just leave it on in the background where you're doing other things. So even if it is terrible, it's very easy to multitask.
I quite agree. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, we're supposed to be in this golden age of TV, which is true because there's so much TV out there. But it also means that there's more bad TV than there's ever been before.
Yes.
So it's a lot of laundry folding while watching TV, answering emails.
Yeah, no, I doubt there's anyone here unfamiliar with that.
What my actual question, when I listed all that stuff, you do a lot.
Thank you.
Do you get easily bored? How are you able to sort of jump from form to form, length to length, between different mediums like this with such ease, or maybe it's not easy?
I don't really know what else to do during the day. I don't go to school anymore, which when you go to school takes up your whole day. And I haven't had a job for a long time. Thank goodness. And so when I finish the thing, I'll take a couple of days where I'll try to catch up on a couple of things that I didn't do because I was doing the other thing. And then I might have one day where I do something like walk lonelily around a beach or sit someplace and read a thing for a long time. But then I would like to do something else. And I'm very inspired by blank paper. I have a lot of blank paper in my house. And I see it there. And I think, let's make some marks on that and see how that goes.
You don't use a computer?
I mean, I do. I use a computer, but I write longhand and then I type it into the computer like a crazy person.
Wow.
I know.
That seems very
Actually, if you want to know the whole story,
please
let's just
tell
keep
us.
This between ourselves. It goes no further than this room. I carry a notebook with me. This is what a notebook looks like if you've never seen one. And I write down things that occur to me or that I eavesdrop or that I read. And then when the notebook is full, I type it into a document on the computer. And then I print out that document. And then I know how this sounds. And then I cut out the things printed on the document and I tape them to index cards.
That's insane.
I know. It's awful.
Why would you do that?
And then I move them around like a crazy person. And then when they're in some kind of order, I begin to write on a legal pad, and then I type that into the computer. It's as if you looked at my activity, you would think he hates trees. That's the problem. Eileen Miles, who is a wonderful poet I admire very much, and she has a book called Sorry Trees, which is, I think, in a way, what every book should be called.
How do you ever get anything done? It sounds like you take twice as long to finish a project than someone who would just type it straight into the computer, like many people do.
Like everyone does. It's very charming that you say many people as if as if I'm on some team instead of being part of a lost patrol. I like paper, and I like when you're writing longhand and you write something terrible, which is almost always, you cross it out, and then it's still there, so you can either remind yourself what was so terrible about it or decide that it wasn't so terrible after all because everything else that you wrote is also terrible, so then you think, well, maybe that wasn't so terrible because I didn't know how bad I was gonna get. And on a computer, if you delete something, I know you can go like Z, Z, Z and try to get it back, but it's gone. And then also when you type something on a computer, this is the worst part, is that you say, well, I better save it. I don't want to lose it. And then it says, oh, yeah, you're writing something? What would you like to call it? It's super mean of the computer. You've typed maybe a sentence, and it says, oh, what is this magnificent thing called? And if you say, I don't know, I was just starting, it says, well, you have to call it something. And so then you call it thing, and then it says humiliatingly, you already have a thing called thing. Do you want to replace this thing with the other thing? And suddenly you're fighting, suddenly. Right? It's like those, you know, when you are, I don't know, in the library, and you say, oh, can I have a scrap of paper? And the person behind the desk says, no. And you think, we're fighting suddenly, what happened? I thought we were friends. And that's how I feel about the computer all the time.
I'm oddly convinced by this process now. Thank you for walking me through that story.
Well, we, and by we I mean human beings, have been writing things on a thing, on a flat thing, for longer than we've been typing them into a thing. So we don't know how that'll go, but it's, even though now I'm obviously in a ridiculous minority here in the first world, but the history of literature was people writing things down, so I like participating in that.
When did you first start writing things down? I've noticed in many of your books there's often a stationery shop. It seems like you really love paper. And I'm trying to picture you as a young boy, maybe, or young man. I don't know how old you were when you first started. A young boy is picking up a piece of paper and starting to write for the first time.
As soon as I could write. I don't remember ever wanting to do anything else. My parents like to tell a story that when I was 5, someone asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up, and I said that I wanted to be an old man who lived on the top of a mountain giving advice. I don't remember that. And my parents are not reliable people. But if that's true, that's the only other thing I ever wanted to be. But I liked instantly reading, and I liked, it felt like a conversation that I wanted to be a part of. There are many things that I enjoy being a spectator to, but this was a part of a conversation that I wanted to be a part of. And it's why I like to go to a book festival. I see the history of the things that people are writing down, that they're thinking and believing and wondering, as being just the closest thing to the universe as we can get. And I love to see how wide and how broad and how deep the literary tradition is, how more and more people's voices are joined to it, and how everybody has something that they would like to write down, probably just about everybody, and that they're writing them down and people are reading them and it is an ongoing conversation. And it seems to me particularly essential now when we also have loud voices that are announcing that things should be narrower, that the conversations should contain fewer people, that not everyone is welcome in one way or another. And that is, it enrages me and saddens me to no end to think that that would be a point of view, because the point of view is that we are all here.
There is a line in the Bad Mood and the Stick, which goes, "By then the bad mood had been all around the world. You yourself had it several times." And not surprisingly, it sort of fit in with what seemed to be a main theme of much of your work, regardless the age of the person reading it, sort of how unpredictable the world is. And whether you're an adult or whether you're a child, it's something you should probably be aware of.
We're already aware of it, yes. Yeah. I think the world is bewildering. And I think that good literature and good stories acknowledge the bewilderingness of the world. So The Bad Mood and the Stick is about a bad mood and a stick, and you don't know what is going to happen with either of those things. They move around throughout a story, and things happen, happy and sad things, and upsetting things, and glorious things. And it's maybe a little simplistic or bare bones in acknowledging the bewilderingness, but I think all good literature acknowledges that. And I think actually that the tradition of strangeness in children's literature, fairy tales and folk tales, all these crazy things that that have been given to young people throughout history, that bear a striking resemblance to the first literature that we can find, which is very strange. And I think that's interesting to me. You read Beowulf, this is a strange book. And to think that the first things that people thought to write down were strange stories, were not something ordinary, but something strange. And I think that is because the world is strange. And there's some theories about folk tales and fairy tales and children's literature that it's the hero's journey or it's the arc that is of comfort and meaning to people. But I actually always think it's the premise. It's the strange thing. Once upon a time, there was a king and his daughter never laughed, and so he had a contest. What? And I think particularly when you're young, that's of comfort to read that because the world is so strange, because you are busy being strapped, say, into a plastic chair that is placed in the back of a vehicle. And you drive, everything's a blur, and then you get out and you're unstrapped and someone says, "This is grandma." And then you read a story, oh, well, we live in a world where the king has a daughter who never laughs, so he has a contest. I guess I can get strapped into this chair. That's of some comfort. So literature that I like is strange because the world is strange to me. It is strange to me to unzip a bag that is holding a suit that you put in a bag to keep safe. And it looks like a murder suit. It looks like a prop on Law and Order, my personal favorite TV show.
I grew up reading the scariest books I could find. I remember specifically reading or taking out from the library Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark.
Yeah, that's
more a good one. Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. Books that at the time, they've since been tempered down, had the most frightening illustrations I'd ever seen in my entire life.
Yeah, those were scary.
And I know, I've read that you, when you were younger, read the books of Edward Gorey, is that correct?
Yes.
Which I only discovered when I was in college.
And that's probably better.
I took a class, and one professor introduced me to the Gashly Crumb Tinies, mm-hmm. which, for those of you who don't know who Edward Gorey is, he was a gentleman who wrote short books and illustrated them, and they were weird, tale set in sort of Victorian or Edwardian eras, but you never really knew, and a lot of things happened that were never really explained. And he wrote this one series called The Ghastly Chrome Tinies, in which each letter is the name of a child, and then he tells you how that child dies.
Yeah, it's a wonderful way to learn the alphabet.
It is. I recall specifically one, I only remember N, which was N is for Neville.
Who died of ennui.
Who died of ennui.
It's my wife's favorite.
Yeah. What weird stuff were you reading as a kid in addition to that?
In addition to Edward Gorey, Zilpha Keatley Snyder, who we lost just recently. She was a wonderful author and a terrific person. She is most famous for The Egypt Game, though my favorite of hers was called The Headless Cupid. She wrote many books about strange things happening, and then almost all of them would be explained, almost all of them. And that, I liked that a lot. Also, she had a great one about getting kidnapped, and I was very interested in getting kidnapped when I was small.
Why?
I just think it's interesting.
Yeah.
When I was very young, I worried about it. I worried about getting kidnapped. And then my father completely accidentally set me at ease once when I said to him, do you think I could be kidnapped? And he said, oh, it's only really rich people who get kidnapped. And which is not true, by the way, but turned out to be okay. As soon as I thought, well, now the chances of me getting kidnapped are very slim, I could think about it just about all the time. Where I might be kept, how you could get out, all the adventures of being kidnapped was very interesting to me. So she wrote a lot about kidnapping. And then Roald Dahl, of course, it'll be surprising to no one who is aware of me and Roald Dahl that I had an appreciation for Roald Dahl. His work, that is. Apparently he was not a nice man.
I've heard that. Yeah. I've heard bad things about him.
Oh, well.
Several of your books involve kids in high school.
Yes.
Who drink lots of coffee and are in drama club or opera club.
What are you saying?
Are hyper literary and very precocious.
Yeah.
Is it a stretch for me to imagine that you were possibly like those kids in high school?
It doesn't sound like it's a stretch for you to imagine it at
okay.
all. No, yes, I was a precocious reader. And so, I think actually particularly in middle school, there was not literature designed for me in a way that there is much literature aggressively designed for middle school students now. So, particularly for boys, which is a whole other issue around reading, but so I just started to read things in my parents' house, which were interesting, and my parents didn't care really which ones I read. So I read a lot of Agatha Christie, which is pretty, I think, speaking of a moral lesson, the fact that if you commit a murder, you'll probably be caught is a great moral lesson, I think, to learn. And then when I got to high school, I met other people who were interested in that kind of thing, and we kind of constructed a world in which we tried to live made of literature and other bits of culture that felt literary in a way. So we had dinner parties, and we did drink a lot of coffee, which at the time, because I'm an old man and this was in the 1600s, coffee was already pretentious, kind of. Now, I don't think we can grasp that, but there was really a time where ordering a macchiato was meant you were maybe from Italy. No one knew what you were talking about. And then you read faster when you've had a lot of coffee. So then we would read more, and then we would get interested and drink more coffee, and it was, it was a lot of fun.
I played video games throughout my high school years, and so when I feel when I read your books and I saw these kids, to me, it was extremely foreign, and I could not imagine being in high school and caring about opera. It's ironic to say that here on the stage of the Oregon Symphony Orchestra, where I believe some kids are going to be playing Beethoven's Fifth tonight.
Right.
As I understand it, you sort of grew up in that world of classical music and opera and maybe didn't really hear popular music until you were a little older?
Yeah, not really. My parents only listened to classical music, and then I had a very strict classical music upbringing, not from my parents necessarily, but I took piano lessons, and then I had a beautiful soprano voice. And so I was in the San Francisco Boys Chorus, which meant that we would perform whenever the opera needed it was mostly urchins, mostly a chorus of street urchins. We would be, and then various masses, which as a Jewish boy was interesting to me. I didn't, the ways of Gentiles became something that I knew more about than other people did. That was interesting to me. But the melodrama of classical music, and particularly of opera, the plots of operas are ridiculous and wonderful. And, you know, the idea that you could read a love letter and think that someone was cheating on you and then fling yourself down the stairs, sing one more song and die. I mean, that's a wonderful story. It's not unlike a video game, I think. I mean, I didn't play very many video games when I was growing up, but you could die over and over again was always very appealing.
How many books had you written by the time you started A Series of Unfortunate Events?
Well, I guess it depends what you mean.
How many books had you published?
When I started writing A Series of Unfortunate Events, I had published no books. The Basic Eight was about to be published when I was starting writing it. And so The Basic Eight and the first two volumes of A Series of Unfortunate Events were published all around the same time. So I'd written some books that were never and will never be published, thank goodness. And then I wrote The Basic Eight, which took forever to be published, and then it was sold to a publisher for the least amount of money my literary agent had ever negotiated for a work of fiction. And then because The Basic Eight is set in high school, somebody asked me if I would be interested in writing something for young people instead of just about young people. And I had been working on this mock gothic novel that wasn't going very well because I couldn't figure out how to make the hero seem really helpless, which is essential in gothic literature. Usually the hero is a woman. She's been married against her will someplace. She's out in the middle of nowhere. Horrible things are going on, and because she's a woman at that era, there's nothing she can do about it. She can't call an Uber. And I was having trouble arranging about it, and then I thought, well, what if it was three orphans? What if terrible things were happening over and over to three orphans? And so then I called this editor who had said, would you be interested in writing something for children, to whom I had said no. I wouldn't be interested. And I knew that the proper thing to do would be to go to a publisher and do some kind of presentation an idea about terrible things happening to orphans over and over again was obviously such a horrible idea that it was the idea that I would be in some professional setting saying that this was my idea was too mortifying. So I arranged to meet her in a bar. And so I went to this bar in New York. It's gone now. It's a beautiful bar. And I got there ahead of time to be a drink ahead. And then I told her the idea, and she said that she liked the idea. And I was very mortified then because first of all, I'd only told the idea so I could just get it out of my head so someone would say, that's terrible, and then it would believe me. And she said she liked it, and then I thought, now she's easily susceptible to alcohol, that's terrible. Because alcohol can make horrible decisions. And so I thought she was making a horrible decision, and that she would say in the morning, as so many people have said, what seemed like a good idea under the influence of alcohol was in fact a terrible idea. So I thought this was going to be one of those ideas, but she's Canadian, so she's actually not easily susceptible to alcohol at all.
I think one of the wonderful things about those books is the tone. And I'm curious to how long it took to get that tone right. What were the steps that you took to sort of modulate just getting that voice right? The voice is...
You charm me so much. I'm very grateful to Mr. Cruz for doing this. He agreed to do this conversation, and it charms me.
What did I say?
Because I'm so flattered that you would believe that a dour, melodramatic outlook spiked with philosophical digression is something that I had to work on in some way. That normally I'm just some practical down-home guy, but I had to say, I wonder what some unbelievably pretentious wool-gathery man would say about a situation like this. How could I grasp that? How could I become? I don't mean to imply that writing comes very easily to me in terms of writing well, because you have to write horrible, horrible things over and over again. As you know, as anyone knows who's written anything down, it's horrible. And then you try to make it better, and it's not hard compared to almost anything else. And so I don't like to think of my profession as full of risk or suffering. There are writers throughout history and in different parts of the world who are under real risk and who are suffering actually for what they are producing. But we, for another 15 minutes or so, are blessed to live in a country where that is not the case. And so it can be tricky to do, but I always have a defensiveness that comes up when someone says, is it hard? I've had jobs, and my jobs were pretty cushy in the history of jobs, you know? Mm-hmm. I never had to help make a road or, you know, put plague victims on a cart or something. But even the jobs that I've had were hard compared to this. This is easy, comparatively. Don't you think so? I mean, you have a blessed job, right?
I have a blessed job because I don't have to write. I just edit other people's writing. Writing is very, very hard to some people, sir.
But there's something self-congratulatory, I think, about some writers who talk about how hard it is or how risky it is. The word risky in particular, people say, I took a lot of risk with this book. And maybe it's just because I know ER nurses or firefighters or something, and I think, what's the risk again? Is the risk like the New Yorker doesn't like it? Is that where this is the danger we're currently under? Or in children's literature, there's some critics, whatever, but mostly it's just people is the word I'm looking for reading them. And again, you don't like it or you like it. One of my favorite children's books of this year is called Orphan Island. It's by Laurel Snyder. It's a beautiful book. It's very strange. You would be well within your rights not to like it, but there's no risk. Oh no, I read a book I didn't like. What will happen now?
I don't think this is a rude question, but how did you write 13 of these without getting bored of it? I mean, is there a list of unused, unfortunate events that you have somewhere?
There were some. I had the advantage of having a small child, my child, just to make that clear, who was born toward the end of when I was writing a series of unfortunate events. So just when I may have been stalled in terms of thinking of terrible things that could happen to children, then, as you know, because you have a small child, that's most of parenting, when you have a small child, is thinking of terrible things that could happen and what you may be able to do about it, right? You learn to look at a room the way you've never looked at a room before, right? You walk in, if it were this room, you would say, well, there's the edge of the stage there, we gotta do that, there's electrical cords, dear God in heaven, this is not really steady, this is glass. That's just off the top of your head. You have to learn to do that all the time. So it was a huge boon with a series of unfortunate events to have a baby, because I just thought, oh my God, look at all these horrible things that could happen.
There's a story about Steven Spielberg. After he directed Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which, to ruin it for some people, sorry, at the end of that movie, Richard Dreyfuss's character leaves with the aliens rather than stay with his family.
Right.
Many years later, he is supposed to have said, if I had directed that movie when I had kids, Richard Dreyfuss's character would not have left with the aliens at the end. That's a terrible thing for a father to do to his family. If you had had a kid when you had started writing these books, have you ever thought of what that would have been like?
I haven't. I like that question. How would it have been different?
Would the events be less unfortunate?
Oh, I don't think so. No. A safe small talk conversation I have found with a young person is to talk about terrible things.
Okay.
So, if you are at a party,
with a kid,
and you don't know what to say, which some people are nervous, or I don't know what their problem is, but they're a great thing to say is, I wonder if this floor could hold as many people as they're standing on it right now. Yeah, or if one of those hors d'oeuvres there was poisoned, just one, who would you want at the party to get it? And who do you just think by their own weird luck would get it? Because it probably wouldn't be the person you would want.
I don't think anyone in this audience is going to let you attend a party with their kid.
Most of them won't, but some of them can't wait. And that is the history of literature.
We are almost to the question portion of the evening.
That's what the flickering light meant.
It's not an evening. It's morning. Why did I say evening?
It feels evening on a theater always.
Yeah. Oh, thank you very much.
Also, the rug makes it appear to be a living room, which is charming to me.
I wanted to ask you very briefly about your latest book, which is called All the Dirty Parts.
Yes.
And which is not appropriate for many of the people in this audience. But I keep hearing kids, so I'm just going to assume.
Yeah. Actually, if all children could cover their ears just for a second. It's about sex. Okay, you can now remove your hands from your ears.
I'm not a prude, but tell us what the book is about and why you wrote it.
I was at a dinner party. I gave a dinner party. In fact, it was in my house. And one of my guests, who is a man married to a man, was telling me that he was going to go to his hometown where he grew up, a small town. And I said, what do you do in that small town? And he said, I like to look up all my ex-boyfriends and their wives. And I got very interested in that. And there began to be a conversation about romance and sexuality at a young age and how slippery and fluid and difficult to pin down desire is. You can cover your ears again if you want to, sex. And about how we are panicked about it all the time, right? It's just about the only topic that anyone would say, we're now gonna talk about a book that's not appropriate for people, right? Even if there are many books that young people would not be interested in reading or would somehow surprise them, but sex is the one that we would get the most nervous about saying that. And that's interesting to me because, for instance, most children are the product of sex. And so I got interested in that. And then meanwhile, I mentioned the gender gap with reading recently, but as a man who writes for young people, there's a gender gap in reading among young people. More girls read than boys, and are reading at a rate that some educators find more pleasing than the way boys are reading. And so I'm often called to come give advice on getting young men to read. And as we mentioned, I'm the last person to come to advice because I was busy reading P.G. Wodehouse and Baudelaire. Why would you ask me how to get young boys to read? It's insane. But I'm invited, so I go. And I reread some of my favorite novels when I was an adolescent, at precisely the age we were talking about, having dinner parties and things like that in high school. And the books had a lot of sex in them. They weren't pornographic and they weren't occupying a place of pornography. It was just something that I liked. And for instance, I like to talk about it, The Mambo Kings Play Songs of Love by Oscar Wuelos, which is a beautiful novel. It is eminently readable if you're in high school. The language is maybe, if you're not in high school yet, maybe too difficult for you, but you could try. It's a story of Cuban immigration and music and fame and the way that when you are from one culture and you enter another culture, the way you want to hold some of it dear and the way you want to share some of it and the way it doesn't always go smoothly. And I can't imagine a more pertinent book right now in America to think about how that is going and how we want it to go. It's really wonderful. Also, it's full of sex, that book. Unbelievable amounts of sex. And so sex is taken out of literature for young people. It was just banned books week a few weeks ago. They listed the top 10 banned books. 9 of them are banned for sexual content. The 10th is banned because it's written by Bill Cosby, which is not the opposite of being banned for sexual content. And meanwhile, the literature that is being offered for adolescents without any fear or any kind of censorship is often about young people killing each other in a post-apocalyptic landscape. That's the literature most often offered to people who should not read about sex, apparently. They should read about murder. And that's interesting to me. And so there's a concern that young men aren't reading enough. There's a topic that we know young men are interested in that we can remember when we were young men, and also, and not that only young men are interested in, and not that it's the only thing they're interested in, but we know this is the thing they're interested in, and we remove it from the literature that we're giving to adolescents, and then we wonder why adolescent boys aren't reading, and then we remove more of it, and we sit around wondering why vegans aren't coming to our steakhouse, and it is driving me insane. So I don't know if the book, I don't know, particularly because I can't see, I can only see about 4 people here. I don't know if the book is appropriate for you or not, but if you are interested in sex, it is called All the Dirty Parts, and if you're not interested in sex, that's fine.
Let's pivot to some audience questions.
Great.
The first one's from a 10-year-old.
Okay. So,
Carly asks, if you were to write a book in a different genre, what would it be and why?
Well, there is a forthcoming Lemony Snicket book. I'm just about done with it, and it is in the genre of philosophical inquiry.
Fascinating. Kids are going to love that.
Well, the book, part of the book begins actually with a conversation that I had with another children's author who wishes not to be identified, but who nevertheless is Sophie Blackall. And I'm only identifying her because she said, so what is this Lemony Snicket book that's forthcoming? And I said, it's kind of a long lyric essay of philosophical inquiry. And she said, nobody wants that.
Do you have a title?
Poison for Breakfast.
Is that the real title?
That's the real title.
That's a great title.
Thank you.
It's better than Thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have a lot of questions here, and I apologize.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
We're not going to be able to get
to
almost any
of them. I'll try to be snappier.
Okay, actually, this one is interesting. They're all interesting.
And of course. All of you are angels.
A child, an unnamed child, asked, according to the handwriting at least, are any of your characters deliberately queer-coded?
Deliberately queer-coded?
Yes. And can you explain what that means?
Yeah.
To those who may not know.
I think both those words have had different meanings over time.
Sure.
So it's an interesting thing to talk about. But I think what they mean is, are any of the characters in any of my books queer, but not outed in the text?
Sure.
So, because many characters in my books are queer and outed. So I don't think that counts as queer coding. I don't know. Certainly it was a, so the answer is yes.
Great answer. Yeah. What is your favorite non-existent color? Explain.
My favorite non-existent color?
Yeah. I'm just going to pick the weirdest ones.
The Despair of Crows. It brings out my eyes.
I think this will be our last question. Leela, a fifth grader, asks, how long does it typically take you to write a book?
Well, I believe I've described my extremely economical process. It really depends on the book. Each volume of a series of unfortunate events, most of them took about 6 months, some of them took a little longer. Sometimes a book will take a long time. It depends what you count. Sometimes you put it away because it's so terrible. I used to keep it in a drawer, then the drawer would stare at me. So I moved it to a fireproof box. For a while I kept it on the crisper of the refrigerator until my wife, I think, made a pretty solid point, which is that it's for food. Because I would say, oh, don't put the tomatoes in the crisper, it'll stain the novel that I'm writing. Just, that was not a harmonious moment in the old marriage. So I keep it in a fireproof box in a closet, and then I take it out again. I never know if that counts if you haven't looked at it for a year, but it takes many months. It's a long time. It's not what I would call suffering. But it is, I like to think of myself as participating in this long thing that has been going on for thousands of years, writing things down and talking about them in a dark room.
I don't know if that is the right, that seems like the right place to end.
That felt like it's
a good
me.
Kicker. Thank you everyone for joining us, and thank you Daniel for speaking to all these
thank
wonderful
you.
People.
And for Mr. Cruz, give it up for Mr. Cruz.
That was Daniel Handler in conversation with Gilbert Cruz at Wordstock, Portland's Book Festival in 2017. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. Find these and more at colehaan.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.